On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Daniel Williams about the history of the pro-life movement. So we cover all sorts of topics like what does it mean to be pro-life? Is it acceptable to use that term as a historian even today? Is that acceptable in the guild? Why do many histories of post-war American politics treat the pro-life movement as a reaction against Roe v. Wade only? Who were the very first to be pro-life? And were Catholics the first pro-lifers? Did they initially see any distinction between some of their own natural law tradition as it relates to things like contraception and abortion? What about Protestants? Where do they fit in? And why was there such a consensus for the legality of abortion initially in the 60s? And a whole lot more. This is a wide-ranging discussion and really fascinating.
As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking.
Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And so when we talk about serious thinking, we mean things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. So we've tried with the podcast and other things that we do to hopefully encourage and cultivate an intellectual culture of those sorts of things. We're prizing interest in other people for who they are and why they think the way they think, but we're also prizing a very critical appropriation or analyzation of what other people are saying and thinking and why they are thinking it that way. So a lot of the podcast is just an opportunity to make friends with new people, to learn new things, and to explore ideas and have lots of fun. So I'm looking forward to introducing you all to Dr. Daniel Williams. We're going to be talking about one of his books. It's a little bit older now, but I think it is as relevant as ever. It's called Defenders of the Unborn, the Pro-Life Movement Before Roe v. Wade. And this is Oxford University Press. And it's still a bit, so if you go on and you go buy it now, it's not like a $100 book from Oxford. It's let me look at Amazon. Right now, it's selling for like $27. So you don't have to sell your left arm to go purchase this Oxford book. You can actually purchase it and still eat later that day. So if you're interested in the book, I tell you, go get a copy of it. Support people like Daniel who are doing the research and the work to help us think about issues and understand them. So Daniel, before we jump in, tell me a little bit about yourself and then what was it that was the really impetus behind researching and writing this particular book?
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show, Jordan. I appreciate the invitation. I teach American history at Ashland University in Ashland, Ohio, but at the time that I wrote this book, I was a professor of history at the University of West Georgia, where I taught for quite a number of years. This was my second historical monograph, my second book. My first one was on the history of the Christian right. It was called God's Own Party. And as I was researching that book, I realized that there was something unique about the pro-life movement, and I wanted to discover what that was. So the reason that I thought that it was unique was because at the time, right around 2010, which was when God's Own Party came out, the Christian right was feeling a bit beleaguered. They were losing on a lot of issues, particularly same-sex marriage. And before that, there had been other causes that they had fought for that had almost completely disappeared, like the quest to restore classroom prayer in public schools. But on the pro-life issue, on the issue of abortion, it seemed that they were making a great deal of progress. There were an increasing number of states that were passing restrictive legislation around abortion. There was some talk, as there had been for quite some time, that Roe v. Wade might eventually be overturned. And public opinion polls were showing that, at the very least, the conservative position on abortion was holding steady. There was some evidence that it might even at that time have been gaining ground among younger people. So the question was, what made the pro-life movement successful? What made the abortion issue different from other Christian right issues? And I wanted to explore that. Initially, I thought I might write a comprehensive history of the pro-life movement, just as I had done with the Christian right. But I found in the course of my research that the really interesting material that could answer that question occurred in the very early years of the pro-life movement, particularly before Roe v. Wade, which was at the time an area of the pro-life movement that had not been studied at all. And so I wanted to tell that story. I wanted to tell the story of what made the pro-life movement different. And as I discovered, it originally was a more of a liberal cause than a conservative cause. And that's what motivated me to write the book.
fascinating. I have like 15 questions or more that I probably want to ask that there's no way I'll be able to get to them all. But maybe I just start with, you are willing to use the term pro-life in this book. Is that acceptable for a historian to use that term? Because I know a lot of people want to push back and say you can't use that term for whatever reason. So I'd be curious to explain the rationale behind being able to use it, even in an academic monograph.
Yeah, the nation's major media outlets, particularly the Washington Post and to a certain extent the New York Times, have policies against using the terms pro-life or pro-choice because they view them as politically charged terms. They're more comfortable with language that's more neutral. I think that there's some merit for that. In other words, we don't want to be inflammatory. But as a historian, I want to be true to my subjects' own thinking about themselves. And particularly when it comes to the pro-life movement, I believe that if you don't call it the pro-life movement, you will miss the major rationale for why it originated. The pro-life term is not just a term of political strategy or convenience. It's not just a marketing device. It's a term that originated several years before Roe v. Wade, and it expressed the concept that opponents of abortion had about themselves. So for someone to be a pro-life activist means more than just that they oppose abortion. It means that they think of themselves as part of a movement of defending human life, and particularly human life before birth. In the same way, I think in the book, I try to be fair to opponents of abortion. And for much of the time period that I'm writing about, particularly the 1970s, the preferred term was pro-choice. Today, some people may call themselves reproductive rights advocates, or they may choose another term. They may talk about reproductive justice. And to be consistent, I try in general to use the terms that people want to use to label themselves. And I think that when we do that, we can better understand the people that we're talking about, even if they happen to be people with whom we might disagree.
Yeah. Now, I imagine most of our listeners are probably very comfortable with the terminology of pro-life, but I ask that just in case we have others who are listening. Now, question on, at the beginning of your book, you mentioned how it might be surprising, potentially surprising, or even uncomfortable in some respects to those more familiar with the histories of abortion legalization. Why do you think that would be?
Well, the history of abortion politics has usually been told, especially at the time that I published this book in 2016. It was, except for a few books published from the Christian perspective, often with Christian publishers, such as the one that Marvin Alasky had written at the time. And of course, now he's written another book more recently on abortion. But except for a handful of books that would fall into that category, most of the academic histories of abortion politics told the story from the perspective of abortion rights advocates. These were people who believed that they were engaged in a cause for human rights. And so the story was told primarily from their perspective. And from their perspective, the opponents of abortion were engaged in a backlash against what they were trying to do. In my history, I argue that actually the opponents of legalized abortion, who would come to be known as pro-life activists, began their campaign long before Roe v. Wade, long before this became a feminist cause, long before a number of people writing about the history of abortion politics have even begun their story. So if we're not going to frame this as a backlash story or an anti-feminist story, that becomes surprising to a number of people who think they know the history, and especially for people who sympathize with the abortion rights cause and view this as analogous to the civil rights movement or the women's rights movement. This is a movement that triumphed over prejudice and backwards thinking, they might say, and repression. The idea that the opponents of abortion might have seen themselves as part of a liberal human rights campaign trying to do something that's very similar to what the civil rights movement was doing is a bit disconcerting. But I hope that people on all sides of the abortion debate will read this book, as indeed they have, and especially read it with an open mind. And I think that even if someone comes from the abortion rights perspective, and even if they end their reading of this book still convinced that abortion should be legally available. I hope that at the very least they would recognize that opponents of their position are also coming from a perspective of deep concern about humanity and deep concern about human rights. There's actually a lot that pro-life activists and pro-choice activists had in common. There were some deep differences, but in terms of the language of human rights, both of them were engaged in a similar project.
Now, to follow up on that, why is it that so many histories of post-war American politics do seem to treat the pro-life movement as a reaction against Roe v. Wade? Because, I mean, I think of a number of examples. I went to Liberty University for my undergrad, and I feel like I hear all the time sort of critics of pro-life movement saying, well, it's a reaction. Jerry Falwell Sr., he didn't actually care about abortion until, you know, XYZ event happened after the fact that then became politically expedient for him to weaponize this as a tool to build a moral majority and whatever else.
Yeah. Part of the issue, I think, has been that people who think they know the history are looking at the wrong players and looking in the wrong places. So the question of when the pro-life movement began cannot be adequately answered by asking the question, in what year did Jerry Falwell Sr. preach his first sermon against abortion? So if we're only looking at particular people, we may miss the real story, or at least the story that I'm trying to tell about the origins of the pro-life movement. And when we look at who was involved in this conversation in the 1960s or even earlier, we may find that they're not people who ever joined the Christian right. They're not people that we've heard of today. So I think that's one major reason for this. The other is that people often look at political parties. And so they would say, well, when did the first partisan platform on abortion enter national political dialogue? That the answer to that would be 1976, when the Republican Party adopted an anti-abortion platform for the first time. And so they might say, well, this was not a political issue before 1976. Again, I think we're often looking in the wrong places. And so what I tried to do in this book was to uncover the story of people who at that point had largely been forgotten, but who were very much involved in political lobbying and in speaking out on this issue.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about these people who seem to have been forgotten.
Well, in the early years, for most of the history that I'm telling, they were overwhelmingly Catholic. There were a handful of others who were not Catholic who were involved in this conversation as well. But the vast majority, probably upwards of 80% of the people who were involved in the pre-Roe pro-life movement were coming from a Catholic perspective. And the Catholic Church, unlike most Protestant churches at that time, had a very firm idea that human life began at conception and should be protected from the moment of conception. They had consistently taken a position against contraception as well. And so as early as the 1930s, when the very first calls for some liberalization of the abortion laws at the time, which would have mostly prohibited abortion except in cases when it was necessary to save a woman's life, when those very first calls were issued, Catholic doctors were ready to push back and to say, this is utilitarian thinking. This is thinking that is saying, well, because the abortion laws are perhaps not working very well, therefore we should liberalize them in order to save the lives of more pregnant women who would otherwise get abortions in dangerous situations from unlicensed practitioners. And they were saying, if the unborn child is indeed a full human being, a full human person, then protecting that child's life is fundamental to what America is all about. And it is the basis for all other human rights. And so they were ready with that argument in the 1930s. And then as the abortion law liberalization movement gained ground in the 1950s and early 1960s, the Catholics were ready to testify at state legislatures and push back against these laws. And they were fairly successful for a number of years. The American Law Institute had proposed a model abortion liberalization bill in 1959, but it was not until 1967 that the first states adopted that. So for about 8 years, what would become known as the pro-life movement was fairly effective at pushing back against these laws. And invariably, they did so on the grounds of absolute human rights, either natural law or absolute human rights principles. They believed they were arguing against relativism or utilitarianism. And they believed that what they were protecting was not just an anti-abortion law, but the most fundamental right in America, that is, the right to life at every stage of existence, that innocent life, they would argue, can never be taken. And if the country would give up on that principle, they believed, a rash of horrors, in the worst case scenario, something like what happened in Nazi Germany, could be unleashed. And so that motivated them to speak out against these abortion liberalization bills.
So why was there then such a consensus for the legality of abortion, at least initially in the 60s?
Well, most Americans did not share a Catholic perspective on the issue if they were not Catholic. Most Protestants at the time were a little unsure about when human life began. There was a general consensus in the early 1960s in both evangelical and more liberal Protestant denominations that the fetus had value, that this was not simply a matter of taking something that was clearly not human life. But at the same time, they were a little uncomfortable saying that it was a full human person with value equal to that of an adult. And so with the initial abortion liberalization bills, those by modern standards would be very modest. They might allow for about 3% of the abortions that occur today, depending on how they're written. So they would allow for abortion in the cases of rape and incest, probably allow for abortions in the case of health dangers to a pregnant woman, maybe suspected fetal deformity. But unless they were liberally interpreted, which on occasion they were, California's therapeutic abortion law was interpreted very liberally by the courts. But if they were interpreted more strictly, as was the case in say Georgia with the law that passed in 1968, they would allow no abortions that we would today consider elective abortions. They were not allowing abortion in the case for simply reasons of convenience or even socioeconomic reasons or severe difficulties that a child might bring into a parent's life. It was rather that there were limited circumstances in which the state had determined that although the fetus had great value, its value was not so great or incontrovertible that it would justify severe hardship to a person in the case of requiring a woman to suffer physical health consequences as a result of her pregnancy. So that was the argument at the time. And because Protestants had already universally, for the most part, accepted the idea that abortion was moral or legitimate in the case of those extremely difficult circumstances in which one had to choose a child's life or the pregnant woman's life, they were already used to the idea that the fetus probably had subordinate value to a woman who was pregnant. And this was simply expanding on that principle a bit. It was also the case that the media at the time made a fairly convincing argument that the restrictive abortion laws were causing unnecessary deaths, that they were out of date, that in the 19th century, abortion had been a very dangerous procedure. Now, because of antibiotics and modern hospital procedures, if practiced by a licensed practitioner, it could become a very safe procedure. And so a combination of the medical argument, the argument that the medical establishment supports this, that we need to simply update the laws, the argument that it's not really going to fundamentally change the way that we think about abortion, the fact that most people outside of the Catholic tradition did not really have a firmly held position that human personhood begins at conception, and the fact that the Catholics had just lost their national campaign against contraception. That is, the Supreme Court in 1965 in Griswold versus Connecticut ruled that laws against contraception were unconstitutional, at least as far as married people were concerned. It would take another 7 years for the Supreme Court to extend that right to unmarried people. But the argument that that married people deserve a certain amount of privacy when it comes to their own sexual practices, that it's that you cannot import, they would say, sectarian religious doctrine into American law, that that's unconstitutional, made many people suspicious of what the Catholic Church was trying to do with abortion. They were saying maybe this is in the same category. And especially if abortion was framed as something that was still generally prohibited, but allowed in these exceptional cases, many Protestants who in the mid-1960s still might have had reservations about premarital sex, still might have had a generally conservative view of sexual morality, would have perceived this as not necessarily a fundamental change from that framework, but rather simply an expansion of the areas in which married women could, in exceptional circumstances, terminate a pregnancy, or an unmarried woman who, through no fault of her own, became pregnant as a result of rape, could terminate the pregnancy. But the 75% of Americans who supported abortion legalization in 1965 for one or more of those reasons that I mentioned generally did not necessarily see this as leading to full-scale legalization of abortion, though Catholics of the time who opposed abortion legalization did push back and say that's exactly what it's going to lead to.
So is there some sort of difference in the moral frameworks between Catholics and Protestants at this time? I mean, you've mentioned like natural law sort of idea for the Catholics. Is that totally absent from the Protestant framework? And if so, I'm curious why you think that is.
It was. I don't go into this in detail in the book, but I've done some more research since then. I may do some more writing on this. Liberal Protestants at the time openly rejected the idea of natural law. In the 1950s, they were heavily influenced by Barthian theology. And I know a lot of your listeners are coming from an informed theological perspective, so they probably are aware of this trend. But neo-Orthodoxy really held sway across much of the Protestant spectrum. Many people who had been liberals a generation before adopted neo-Orthodoxy. So a place like Union Theological Seminary in New York was heavily influenced by neo-Orthodoxy. Princeton Theological Seminary, overwhelmingly neo-Orthodox. But even in some Southern Baptist circles at the time, people who perhaps had been maybe a bit more evangelical a generation before were moving into neo-Orthodoxy. So neo-Orthodoxy had widespread currency in the 1950s. And because of the very strong Christocentric nature of neo-Orthodoxy and the suspicion of the idea of natural revelation, Bart, for example, went so far as to completely reject any form of natural theology whatsoever, to say you could not know even the existence of God from nature, that God only revealed himself through Christ. That idea made it impossible to really believe in natural law. And so perhaps a perspective, a particular application of Reformed and Lutheran theology that maybe went beyond the Reformers, but had a very strong theology of original sin, a very strong suspicion of the human conscience, and a strong belief in Christocentric only revelation, made Protestants feel comfortable for the first time simply rejecting natural law. And they were used to doing that in the 1950s because the most prominent area in which Catholics appealed to natural law at the time was in the area of contraception, which all of the mainline or liberal Protestant denominations accepted in the 1950s, and which some evangelicals were beginning to accept in the 1950s as legitimate. In fact, Protestants at the time, or liberal Protestants, not only saw contraception as permissible, but as a positive good, even as a Christian duty, to promote this in order to foster what they would call responsible parenthood and to alleviate poverty. So if they were pushing back against Catholic natural law thinking, they found it was easier not simply to say, well, the natural law doesn't prohibit contraception, but to say there is no real natural law philosophy. It's simply a sectarian invention. Among evangelicals, who at the time still in many cases would have been using the term fundamentalist, even as late as the 1960s, they would have been much more comfortable reasoning from the Bible rather than natural law. There had been a very long and continued tradition of suspicion of Catholic theology, particularly when it came to claims about extra-biblical revelation. And so while evangelicals and even very conservative fundamentalists would have been comfortable with some form of natural theology in terms of evidence for God, they might have been repeating some of Thomas Aquinas's proofs for the existence of God without even always knowing they came from Thomas Aquinas. But even if they did, they would have accepted those as legitimate, but would not have ever really been comfortable talking about a larger natural law framework. Their basis of moral reasoning came from the Bible. And so when evangelicals began seriously trying to determine in the late 1960s whether abortion was permissible in any case, their arguments usually revolved around biblical interpretation. The question of whether this somewhat obscure and difficult to understand passage in Exodus 21 about what happens when a pregnant woman is injured, is that a miscarriage? Is this not a miscarriage? Does the child die? Is it talking about that sort of injury? That was a debate that a lot of evangelicals became very engaged in on both sides, because it was something that they could understand. It was about the Bible, and the answer to this biblical question they thought would give them the answer to the question about abortion. The idea that they should appeal to church tradition, as Catholic theologians did, or even more, should they appeal to natural law reasoning, was not the way that most evangelicals of the time would have been comfortable debating moral questions.
Got it. So what were the key strategic changes that the pro-lifers seemed to be making in the late 60s and early 70s that seemed to help the cause?
Well, perhaps the most significant one was what Father James McHugh, the creator of the National Right to Life Committee, did in the late 1960s, was that he tried to completely dissociate the movement from any discussion of contraception. He said that contraception and abortion were two completely different issues. From the Catholic perspective, of course, they were both wrong, and both wrong on natural law grounds, but he argued that they were wrong to a different degree. So the Catholic Church, while still saying that contraception should not be practiced, accepted the fact that this could not be a legal position. Whereas because abortion actually took the life of a human being, they said, therefore it was appropriate to argue against that in the legal sphere. And then he also tried to bring in a lot of as many non-Catholics as he could find to be given prominent places in the pro-life movement, to lead state pro-life organizations when possible, because he wanted to make sure that this would not be branded as a Catholic sectarian campaign. So to distance the church hierarchy from being the public face of the pro-life movement, and to make ideally non-Catholics prominent spokespersons for the pro-life cause, would be key to winning their day in court or in legislative hearings.
So you've mentioned how, I guess at the beginning of the pro-life cause, there was some liberal aspects to it. And today, if you looked out across the political landscape, it seems that it's very clearly you can't be pro-life if you're Democrat. Now, if you're Republican, I mean, I guess the official platform is pro-life, but whether they are actually pro-life or not is another question. So in this period, in the 60s and 70s, is it crossing political boundaries? Is this really a one-party thing, or do different people have different opinions on this?
It was definitely crossing political boundaries. And in fact, in the early 1970s, if there was one party that was maybe more likely to support the pro-life cause, one might have even guessed it would be the Democrats. A majority of pro-life activists were probably Democrats. There are no firm figures on this, but certainly a number of prominent pro-life leaders identified very strongly with the liberal wing of the pro-life of the Democratic Party. And the reason for that was because many of them were coming from a Catholic social justice perspective. as late as the end of the 1960s, about two-thirds of American Catholic voters were Democrats. And many of them accepted the principles of the New Deal, the idea that the state should care for the less fortunate, that government growth, if it's the growth of the welfare state, is not necessarily a bad thing. And they framed the pro-life cause in those terms. What they wanted was not simply the government to stay out of the abortion business, but rather they wanted the government to protect human life from the moment of conception. And many of them believed that part of that protection would not simply be making abortion illegal, but providing some form of aid to women facing crisis pregnancies. A number of pro-life organizations took that stance in the early 1970s. So in the early 1970s, some pro-life activists included very prominent liberal Democrats like Ted Kennedy, who from about 1971 until 1975, when he reversed his stance, was a supporter of protecting human life from the moment of conception. Throughout the 1970s, Jesse Jackson, the civil rights activist who would later run for president on the Democratic ticket, run for the Democratic presidential nomination, was very firmly in support of the pro-life cause. In fact, he even wrote an article for the National Right to Life News. So there were a number of Democrats in the 1970s, including some on the liberal wing of the party, who supported the pro-life cause. And there were also a number of prominent Republicans, including some conservatives, who supported abortion rights. So Barry Goldwater, who was probably the best known conservative leader in the Republican Party at the beginning of the 1970s, was a strong supporter of Planned Parenthood and supported abortion rights on libertarian grounds. And in fact, there were more Republican governors than Democratic governors in the late 1960s and early 1970s who signed into law legislation to legalize or at least liberalize their state abortion laws.
So I think if I remember correctly, you mentioned something along the lines of if pro-lifers had based their opposition just merely on religious teaching or what would be considered arcane principles of natural law, they would have failed. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is?
Well, the nation is religiously pluralistic. At the time, about 25% of Americans were Catholic. And so if you're making arguments that will only appeal to Catholics, you will get at most 25% of the population supporting your cause. At the time, the Catholic Church was also going through quite a bit of change and even upheaval because of Vatican II. And as a result of that, by the end of the 1960s, a significant number of Catholics, maybe a third or so, disagreed with the church's stance on abortion. So even getting to that 25% number would probably be very difficult. So the pro-life activists from the beginning of their first losses, I guess, in 1967, realized that they needed to recalibrate, realized that if they wanted to be more than a regional campaign with a foothold in more than just the most Catholic states of the nation, that they would have to push back against any sectarian tendencies in their movement and try to speak in the broadest language possible, appealing to universally shared, or at least broadly shared, American principles.
So this is an interesting question. I don't know if you have the answer to this, but since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, there seems to be almost two, I guess, groups in my mind of what would you have a discernible pro-life movement, and then you'd have like an abolitionist movement. And it seems that there's a significant number of people saying, no, the position has always been pro-life and not abolitionist, whereas the abolitionist wing will say, no, it's always been abolitionist. Was there a discernible like grouping like this in this period? Were there abolitionists, or is that a later development?
Well, the way in which the term is used today, I think, represents a distinct break from the pro-life movement. So that today, when people talk about being abolitionists, I think part of that often involves treating abortion as murder and punishing as murderers anyone who participates in an abortion, including the woman involved. And I'm not aware of any pro-life activist of the early 1970s who took that position. In fact, a significant number were not really that interested in talking about punishment for anyone. This was not primarily a punitive campaign. This was a campaign to enshrine rights. So they viewed it as analogous to the civil rights campaign. The most important concern for Martin Luther King Jr. was not how to punish people who were segregationists. In fact, that thought would have been rather abhorrent to him. It was rather to protect civil rights in law. And that's the way that a lot of the early pro-lifers would have thought of this as well. So the modern punitive aspect is new. The other thing that I think is also new is the degree to which the pro-life cause has for many people been wrapped up in Christian nationalism. So this, for many pro-life activists today, who to a large degree are no longer coming from Catholic circles, and even if they're coming from Catholic circles, they're definitely not coming from the same Catholic environment that produced the early pro-life movement. They're not coming from the basis of a 20th century Catholic social justice framework or comprehensive political ethic that would have guided Catholic support for the New Deal or something of that nature. They're not people who are thinking of some of the documents of Vatican II as being foundational for their political thought. And as a result, there's a strong correlation between passing a stronger anti-abortion law and making the country more of an overtly Christian nation. So that Christian nationalism really wasn't a part of the early pro-life movement, particularly not the pro-life movement from 1967 to the late 1970s. Especially under Father McHugh's direction, the National Right to Life Committee really tried to avoid any hint of sectarianism. The most prominent book that defended the pro-life point of view called Handbook on Abortion that was produced by Dr. Jack Wilkie and his wife, Barbara, was a book that avoided any reference to religion whatsoever. They were trying to strictly argue on the basis of scientific and philosophical grounds, common sense philosophical grounds as they would have seen it, which is a popular translation, we could say, of the Catholic natural law argument. And so for Catholics, it was very easy for most of them to switch to non-theistic language or certainly non-sectarian language, because the argument behind natural law theology is that there are certain moral principles that are accessible through reason alone. And so they thought they could tap into those and avoid any discussion of the religious framework for these arguments. But today, I think a significant number of people in the pro-life movement are evangelical Protestants who have been deeply influenced by Francis Schaeffer and some of his successors. And Schaeffer was deeply influenced by presuppositionalism. And this, again, goes beyond my book, but I think it's relevant for this question. The presuppositionalism of Cornelius Van Til and other people would say that there really is no common moral language that we have, that where we can talk to unbelievers on common grounds. If there is, it's simply a carryover from revelation that by God's common grace, maybe other people have access to that in part, but really we shouldn't be trying to find common philosophical principles on which we all agree. And regardless of what you think about that view, if you take that view into the political arena, you almost by necessity have to end up in somewhat of a Christian nationalist position to argue for the framework. I realize, of course, there are many people who can separate that theologically from its political dimension. And I think there's a good case that can be made for that. But if you don't separate it and you take your theological reasons for opposing abortion into the political sphere, then the pro-life movement starts to look very different than it did in the early 1970s. And I think that's the position that we're in today. Nearly every state that has passed a restrictive abortion law is a state where evangelical Protestants have more influence than Catholics. The only exception would be Utah, which is neither, which of course was influenced by the LDS Church. But in most other states with restrictive abortion laws, these are not heavily Catholic states. The states of New England that were traditionally the most strongly Catholic states in the nation are states that now, because of secularization and because of a Catholic backlash in those areas against church teaching, have tended to be the strongest supporters of abortion rights. So as a result, the politically at least, the pro-life movement is going to look very evangelical, which is not what it looked like in the early 1970s.
Very interesting. Tell me, can you give me like an example of what constitutes Christian nationalism? Because depending on who I talk to, it can mean anything and everything.
Right. Yeah. So the way, and of course I am aware of, you know, how people have recently gotten into trouble by defining it too broadly or wrongly. But the way that I would define it is that it's a belief that the United States was founded as a Christian nation on Christian principles, and that its existence in its current form depends on a perpetuation of that Christian identity. And so to the extent that the country is deviating from Christian identity in law or in politics or maybe in the culture at large, it needs to be brought back to that. So there's a conflation of Christianity with the identity of the nation and the belief that the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence simply don't work if we don't presuppose Christianity as their foundation.
Got it. Does that belief sort of ebb and flow, do you think, throughout the history of America?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think, and it's tricky because I think Christian nationalism has provided a needed historical corrective to another false belief that the country was founded on secular principles, that the Constitution demands this strict wall of separation between church and state is the argument, and people wanted to get rid of any influence of religion in the public sphere. And so certainly throughout the 19th century, you can read a lot of legal decisions and popular expressions of political opinion and presidential speeches that would be very hard to interpret from that secular lens. And the question becomes, I mean, I think it's fair to say that religion has had, and Christianity in particular, in various forms, not always an evangelical form, but in various forms, has had a much greater influence on the political structures of the nation and the politics of the nation than what many people who are thinking of this strictly from a secular point of view might imagine. That has never been the case that that religion was completely privatized and that the public sphere was shorn of all religious references. So yeah, I think that belief, both the belief that the nation was founded on Christian principles and that the nation needed to return to Christian principles, can be found at various points. So the quest for a Christian amendment to the Constitution that would say that the United States is under the lordship of Jesus Christ was first introduced in the 1860s. And there've been moments of that cycling back. Once again, in the late 1940s, there was another strong push for that amendment. Of course, it never was adopted, but the fact that you can point to these moments can be signs, I think, of what we might, in retrospect, call a form of Christian nationalism.
Interesting. You know, I still remember, I don't remember a lot of the convocations I had to sit through in my undergraduate studies, but one of them had the historian hack, David Barton.
Yes.
And he gave his whole like spiel on how, you know, America was founded on like literally like, it's like if you just read between the lines, every little thing, even diagonally, is Christianized in some way. Like if you read every fourth letter, you get whatever special message. It was fascinating. But it seems like there has been a latent view of those sort of things even prior to the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, it seems, where it has become a much more popular term.
Right. Well, and right, the term Christian nationalism is fairly recent, but the idea is not. And I think the Christian right of the 1980s was very Christian nationalist by the modern definition of Christian nationalism. So it's not a new idea. And I would also say this, that one of the problems from, so this is kind of deviating from our script here, but the when we look at Christianity and politics in various forms, one of the problems is that it's easy to lose the context for that. So I recently wrote a blog post called Civil Religion is Not Christian Nationalism. So when we look at, say, Eisenhower giving a prayer at his own inauguration, immediately talking about the Almighty and the Almighty's purposes and the Cold War and all of that, that has traditionally been labeled Christian national. That's traditionally been labeled civil religion. It would be easy to look at it as Christian nationalist if we didn't know from a historical perspective that what he was trying to do in that inaugural address and his prayer was to be very ecumenical. So while it looks on the surface to be very Christian nationalist, he didn't mention Jesus Christ. And there's a very obvious reason for that. You know, he's trying to be part of this this tri-religious America, the Protestant, Catholic, Jews, people would have phrased it then, and unite everyone under this civil religion. Whereas modern Christian nationalism is primarily an identity movement. It's analogous in some ways to the European right today in sort of a post-Christian context where people are saying, what is the identity of this nation? We're going to reclaim it for God, with God being perceived as sort of our own tribal identification. And that's where it becomes tricky when we're looking back at moments in time, that there's no question that the country had a very strong religious identification of some sort, a very strong theistic framework for American politics, but not necessarily the same partisan nature of the Christian nationalist campaign. And to circle back to the pro-life movement, I think in the late 1960s and early 1970s, one can find certainly references to God in the pro-life movement, and certainly most of the people in the pro-life movement would have been fairly religiously devout or very religiously devout. But for the most part, they saw the success of their campaign as depending on an ecumenical appeal. So the idea that this would have to get wrapped up in a campaign to reclaim America for Christian values perhaps would have surprised them. They would have seen this as a campaign that whose success depended on a broadly ecumenical appeal.
Well, this is all super fascinating. So tell me, where's the best place to go to keep up with all the resources that you have, whether that's books or these other online essays that you've been writing?
Yeah. Well, I regularly write for The Anxious Bench and for Current, more occasionally, but still fairly regularly for Christianity Today. And so if people, you know, I have sites on The Anxious Bench and on Current where people can go to find my articles. There's also a website that people can look up where I just have my CV and a few basic things posted. But I would say following The Anxious Bench, Current, Christianity Today would probably allow people to find most of what I'm writing on these issues today.
Awesome. Do you have any book projects that you're currently working on?
Yes. I'm writing a history of Christian apologetics that is under contract with Oxford University Press that will probably be published next year. And I'm also working on a history of religious attitudes toward abortion. That's under contract with Notre Dame. I'm not quite as far along with that, but that may be a 2026 publication date. But I think there's more to say along these lines than what I was able to say in Defenders of the Unborn.
Very cool. And the final question is, at Ashland, do you teach undergraduate or do you have graduate courses there as well?
I teach both. So I'm teaching a U.S. History Survey course that's undergraduate, and we also have a master's degree program that's primarily oriented toward teachers. It's called Masters in American History and Government. And so I'm teaching an online course there.
Very cool. Well, we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us through this. So if you're interested in getting the book, which I commend you to do, I'll have the link in the show notes that you can just click. It takes you right there, and you can get a copy to support people like Daniel and the work that they're doing. and be on the lookout for these other resources that he's mentioned, because maybe you're listening to this in 2026 and the other books are available. So you can go find them at that point online or wherever you do your book shopping. Well, thanks everybody for listening and tuning in to another episode of the London Lyceum. And we look forward to talking with you all soon, as this has been the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.